I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, a new study from a group led mostly by Stanford economists and sociologists, also including people from Harvard and UC Berkeley, shows that half the children born in the 1980s grew up to earn more than their parents did after adjusting for inflation. But that is a drop from 92% of children who did better than their parents if they were born in 1940. The falloff is particularly steep among children born in the middle class and for those born in several states, including the industrial Midwest. The authors of the report say if policymakers care about giving more Americans a chance to out-earn their parents, these results show that you have to care about inequality. Joining us this hour to talk about all of these important issues is Professor Robert Pflugi. He's a research fellow at the Stanford Institute of Economic Policy Research and co-author of this latest study by the Equality of Opportunity Project. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure that many of you have stories from your families, and so many stories there are about young people who are entering the world of work and having a much more difficult time finding jobs that pay well, having to work more than one job, and certainly not doing as well as their parents. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest, and here is the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read your comments, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that is at K Dunn Show. Professor Pflugi, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
today.
Great to have you here. This first statistic I read is really quite amazing, that half the children born in the 80s grew up to earn more than their parents, but it's a drop from 92% of children who were born in 1940. What happened in the ensuing years from 1940 to the 1980s?
That's absolutely right. So essentially what we've seen over the past, 40 or 50 years is that there has been a constant and pretty steep decline in the percentage of children that are earning more than their parents. Now, as you said, for children born in 1940, that number was above 90%, and it was above 90% for most areas of the income distribution as well. Now, that has dropped precipitously to 50%, essentially a coin flip today.
Yes. And we
think, that that is really concentrated most steeply in the middle class. So the middle class is where our metric has really seen the largest declines.
And in order to look at all of this, you need to also examine inequality, because you talk about the rising concentration of income among the richest Americans, which explains what's been a steady decline in mobility for young people.
That's absolutely right. So you can think of two major macroeconomic forces over the past 50 or so years. One is that aggregate GDP growth, that is the growth of the economy, the number, the kind of number you would see on the front page of, a newspaper, has declined since 1940. But the concentration of growth, that is the share of that money that is going to different levels of the income distribution, has really concentrated among a few people. And so what we tried to do is we tried to kind of break those two forces apart and see how much did each of them contribute to the decline in what we call absolute mobility. And what we found is that about 70% of the decline is due to the changing distribution of growth, that is the money going to fewer and fewer people, rather than the overall decline in GDP growth.
Mm-hmm. So those young people who were born, let's say, in the 60s, who have entered the workforce or maybe didn't have to because they inherited family money or whatever, have you looked at that narrow group, the children of the wealthiest? They have done better than their parents or not as well as their parents or what?
Yeah, so the children of the very wealthiest, say the top 10%, 5%, even the top 1%, all of them are also doing worse than their parents on average. Now, that decline is less steep, you would say, among that group than among the middle class. But we've certainly seen a decline actually across the income distribution. Now, the reason that we might expect the decline to be a little bit less steep or more steep, rather, at the top of the income distribution, the very wealthiest, is that their parents, if you were born, say, in the top 1%, your parents are already earning a lot of money, and it's relatively more difficult to beat them. The bar, essentially, is higher than if you were born, say, in the middle class.
Mm-hmm. What about if you're poor?
If you're poor, you actually see a similar effect. That is, absolute mobility, your chances of beating your parents have declined, but not as much as for the middle class. Now, the reason that is if your parents are very poor, say you're in the top or the bottom 10% of the income distribution, your parents are already not earning very much money, right? So you already have a pretty high chance of beating your parents. Now, we have certainly seen a decline there as well, but it's relatively easier than somebody born to poor parents for them to beat their parents than somebody born in the middle class or the upper class.
You mentioned in the study that increased trade and advanced technology have closed off traditional sources of middle-income jobs. Can we talk more about that and what else has happened to middle-income jobs? What they are even now? What's a middle-class job?
Sure. So I think, you know, going back to really the main point that these declines are concentrated among the middle class, and you see them concentrated particularly, as you noted earlier, in the upper Midwest, the industrial Midwest, I think it's certainly reasonable to talk about how the advance of technology has made some of the jobs that previously were middle class really, you know, they've gone away, for lack of a better term. You're seeing, you know, less manufacturing in some areas, less manufacturing jobs. Maybe people whose parents were in the middle class had a good manufacturing job at a car company or something like that, and those jobs just might not be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can also think of, you know, other potential forces. So the change from really a manufacturing economy to a service economy is sort of going on over this time period. And so the types of jobs that you see among people in the middle class have really changed pretty substantially.
And are there certain industries that aren't in the industrial Midwest that have taken their place? They may be small. I'm thinking about renewable energy or building robots or something that has started to grow but is nowhere near the kinds of manufacturing jobs we used to have, or is that even non-existent?
I would say that that's perfectly reasonable to talk about. Now, that really, I would say, wasn't the focus of our study. We didn't really dive into sort of an industry-level look at what's going on here, but I think that's you're probably right on track that, you know, there were these large, say, manufacturing, middle-class jobs, blue-collar jobs that might not be there anymore. And there are certainly other sorts of industries, as you note, renewables being potentially a large one in the future, that might offer some jobs to those folks whose parents had sort of the manufacturing jobs. But I would say that many of those industries are not really comparable in size or scope to what you had in manufacturing in, say, you know, the 1940s or the 1950s.
Another finding here, and there will be young people who are listening right now who will say, oh, no, don't tell me that. What people earn early in their careers, in the first 10 years perhaps, is a good indication of how much their earnings might grow over their lifetimes. Heavens, there are a lot of young people who aren't making very much money.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So one of our ancillary findings as we're going through this project is that your rank in the income distribution, that is, if you think about taking everybody that was born in a certain year and ranking them by how much money they earn at a given age, that your rank compared to other people born the same year as you is relatively constant by age 30. So that's not to say that the amount of money that a person will be making at age 30 necessarily tells you exactly how much they'll be making at age 50, but compared to their peers, by age 30 you have a pretty good idea of where they're going to fall later in life.
Mm. But what about the fact that we change jobs so frequently? We hear that you'll have 7, 8, maybe even more jobs during a lifetime. This doesn't necessarily mean then that you're going to graduate into jobs that are more lucrative than what you just had.
Well, I think that might very well be true, but I would also make a distinction between sort of the level of income and your income compared to people around you. Now, that is to say, if you have a job at age 30, you are very likely to be making more money. Say you get promoted or you change jobs or something, you're very likely to be making more money at age 40 than you were at age 30. Mm-hmm. But you also have to remember that everybody else is also likely to be making more money. And so in comparison to other people, you're not likely to move up or down in the income distribution after age 30. Essentially, your place in the income distribution, on average at least, is relatively constant after age 30.
Let's talk about what would improve economic mobility. You have been critical or saying that the tax cut plans that Donald Trump has proposed would do little to improve economic mobility. Does the president-elect, has he spent much time talking about income inequality? He certainly reached voters who have been affected by income inequality. But what about those tax plans?
So really, I would say that was not a particular focus of ours. We are not, you know, political scientists by any stretch of the imagination. But I think it's fair to say, really, that when you look at sort of the overall political mood of the country, a lot of people are really feeling as though they've been left out from the growth in the economy that our country has seen. And I think that in large part that might have something to do with, you know, the results that we saw in the election. Now, I would say what our findings really strongly advocate for is finding a way to increase equality in the distribution of income growth. That is, the income is going to grow, you know, GDP in this country is going to grow at some rate, and if we can find a way to make sure that is distributed more equally among individuals and is not concentrated among a few, that would, by our study, go a long way to reducing or increasing absolute mobility in the United States. Now, in terms of Donald Trump's particular tax plan, I don't know if I'm in a position to say whether or not it would sort of conform to these ideas, but I do know that there have been sort of other independent groups that have said that his tax plan is likely to increase concentration of wealth to certain demographics.
Mm-hmm. So is there a way, other than the way we tax, to make sure that we increase distribution in income wealth?
Yes,
how do we do
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
All right,
absolutely.
Good. How do we do it?
So, you know, if you want to leave the whole tax code issue aside, which is very complicated and politically difficult in many ways, I think what a lot of people can agree on is that we want some sort of equality of opportunity. And what a lot of our previous studies have shown is that the environment that one grows up in, that is one's childhood environment, where you live, say, from ages 0 to 23, really seems to matter in how much money you make. Now, that sort of tells you quite a bit, right? If you can invest in either moving people to places that look very good, that are sort of driving good outcomes for children that grew up there, or you can improve the places that don't look quite so good. And I think that investing in things like education, for example, in many areas would go a long way towards increasing sort of the equitable distribution of growth that one would want to see if absolute mobility were to improve in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Anything other than education? And talk more about those places. What do those places look like?
Yes, absolutely. So the places that look poor, or at least relatively poor compared to other places, in terms of sort of driving higher incomes for children that grow up there, tend to have high levels of segregation. They have high levels of urban sprawl. They have relatively poorer sort of educational outcomes. And so I think some of the things that you can look at, you know, I mentioned education earlier, that improving the quality of education in some places that maybe don't look quite as good or is not quite as competitive as some other areas of the country. But you can also look at what a lot of people would think of as more mundane things. So if urban sprawl is sort of an issue, or at least is correlated with some of these bad outcomes, one could imagine investing in better public transportation or better ways to expose individuals, you know, young individuals, to some of the innovation that's going on in the area around them.
You'd probably also need to have good family-supporting jobs, wouldn't you, to have a tax base for better education?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, places that economically are struggling oftentimes will have poorer outcomes for children for probably precisely that reason, that it's, you know, it's difficult to invest in some of these things that probably everybody agrees are important, transportation, education, if you have difficulty raising the money to pay for it. Now, I also think that there are probably other ways in which a poor local economy, you know, or lack of jobs in a local area can affect outcomes. It's probably not just through investment in education, but, you know, a higher percentage of single-family households or households that don't have a stable income or stable housing. But certainly, you know, the local economy does matter.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking this hour about a study by the Equality of Opportunity Project that shows a number of things, that the rising concentration of income among the richest Americans explains 70% of what's been a steady decline in absolute mobility from the baby boom generation to millennials, while a slowdown in economic growth explains 30%. It's tough to grow up if you don't have that kind of widespread economic growth. It's tough to grow up and earn more than your parents, and the study shows that it's pretty significant that if you were born in 1940, you had a 92% chance of doing better than your parents. If you were born in the 1980s, half of the young people will grow up to do better than their parents. And much of this is determined, my goodness, in the first 10 years of being in the job market. Joining us this hour is the co-author of this study from the Stanford Institute of Economic Policy Research. Robert Pflugi is a research fellow there. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Obvious question is, what do we do to make equality of opportunity prevalent for poor people and middle-income people? The rich are doing okay, but these are pretty astounding kinds of statistics about how well people will fare as they enter the workforce. And we've heard that from young people and people concerned about this for years now. So we'll go to you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in, and we start with David in Oshkosh. Hello, David.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, fine. Thank you.
All right. I have a question for the professor here, and I'm just wondering what his opinion is on this. He had mentioned macroeconomics earlier and a shift in that and a result in a slowing down of the GDP. I'm curious as to what his take is on the traditional Keynesian economics that we were going through the early part of the 20th century, and then the shift in the 80s under Reagan and Thatcher to a more neoliberal economic structure and how that resulted in turn. One quick comment regarding the next topic that you wanted to talk to about the echo chamber. It ties into this idea. The godfathers of neoliberalism have been fighting against this for 50, 60, 70 years. Murray, Rothbard, Hayek, they have been saying this forever. This isn't some new idea that they is all of a sudden popped out that can't become a liberal echo chamber. This there. I'll take my original question, though, off air, and thank you guys very much.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Robert.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's an excellent question. Now, one of the really stark findings of our study is that actually the decline in absolute mobility has been essentially constant over the past 40 or 50 years. That is, across administrations, across economic policies, you've really seen ever since 1940 that this metric has essentially been in constant decline. And so I think that, you know, whether or not you you subscribe to a more Keynesian or Hayekian or whatever sort of economic policies you subscribe to, it's certainly been the case that GDP growth has fallen. And that certainly has affected some of the metrics that we see in our study. Now, I would say that that effect, that force, has been much less pronounced than the increase in income inequality or the growth in income inequality, such that a greater and greater proportion of the growth is going to fewer and fewer people. But I really do think that this is not sort of an issue that's been confined to one particular set of economic policies or one particular, you know, group of administrations, that the declines that we've seen have really been pretty constant ever since the beginning of our data set, which starts in 1940.
Mike writes on Facebook, if success is measured by how far a person comes from his beginnings, then it's of small wonder why today's young adults have so much trouble achieving it. They've started further ahead than any generation in history. Also, older adults are not dropping out of the workforce for a variety of reasons, and young adults are competing with those who in earlier generations would have already left openings for them to fill.
Yes. Now, I think that that's a really excellent point, and it's really not something that we can say a whole lot about just with the numbers in our study. Now, it is certainly true that the families of children that were born in 1980 were, in real economic terms, much better off than the families of people that were born in 1940. But I think that if you want to view the issue of the American dream as sort of achieving a benchmark set by your parents, sort of that vision of the American dream that you can have in your own household, that by that metric alone, the American dream has certainly declined from 1940 to 1980. Now, I think that it is important to keep in mind, again, that a lot of this is due to a change in the distribution of growth in the United States. So it's not just the case that, you know, everybody is or everybody is coming from a family that's better off, but fewer and fewer of those families are sort of seeing the gains that the economy has been making over the past 50 years.
And you also look at what's happened to the workforce. I mean, my goodness, the changes are enormous. The fact that it's two people working now in a family in order to live a modest middle-class life, and all the expenses that people have with two people working, with childcare, et cetera, it's a whole different world.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, workforce dynamics along gender lines, along industry lines, have changed really drastically over this time period. Now, this is something that we did explore a little bit, thinking that perhaps it was, you know, an increase in, say, the number of households that have two parents working and thus might be more difficult for a child to make more money than their parents. But even if you confine your analysis to, say, sons and their fathers and the individual wage income of those two people, you still see almost exactly the same declines as you do when you measure sort of the whole family's income. So it's certainly true that those, you know, changes in workforce dynamics have been very pronounced over the past 50 years, but I think that they actually explain less of the decline, less of that decline that we see than one might expect.
Let's go to Ken and Eau Claire next. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. Happy New Year to both of you.
To you as well.
Thank you. I'd like to question the basic premise that somehow doing better than your parents is a very good measure of what's happening to people economically and I guess more just contentment in life and life satisfaction. I can see at a certain income level that's probably true, but at other levels, I'm wondering as a society if we don't need to spend more energy and time thinking about those who have a lack of opportunity to better themselves, have many obstacles in their way to better themselves, taking care of those and raising that particular level and being concerned about that. As far as I know from the things that I've taught in the past and the things that I've read, income around $100,000 a year, and this is, you know, obviously just a general number, but much over that, so-called happiness factor seems to go away. And I'm just wondering if it's not a better measure for our country to look at itself and say, what are we doing for people who simply have to scrape and scrap every day to try to get ahead at all and not be concerned about the measure of did we do better than our parents? So.
It's an interesting point. Thank you, Ken. Robert?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely a question, a wonderful question, and I would agree with some of the sentiments there that, you know, really beating your parents is only one measure of what's been going on in the economy. And certainly it can be argued that it is not the only or even the most important way of understanding changes in economic mobility in the United States. Now, I would make two points, I think, here. One is that most of the declines that we see in the chances of somebody beating their parents are actually concentrated below that $100,000 mark. So it's really been sort of the middle class, you know, the middle, say, 20th percentile of the income distribution to the 80th percentile of the income distribution, most of which, the vast majority of which, are below $100,000 in family income that has seen the steepest declines in absolute mobility. The other point that I would make, and this actually, you know, is a really excellent question and speaks to some of the previous work that our group has done. We did a study looking across the United States at the chances that a person born in the bottom fifth, the bottom 20% of the income distribution, would eventually reach the top fifth of the income distribution, you know, a different sort of more relative measure of economic mobility. And we actually find that a lot of the places that look bad by this absolute mobility metric, the chances of beating your parents, also tend to look bad by that relative mobility metric. That the places where it's tougher to beat your parents are also the places where it's tougher for a child that is born in poverty to end up in the top fifth of the income distribution. And that sort of suggests that there might be, you know, similar forces, similar causes, at least some sort of connection between these two phenomena. And I think that they're both very important to think about when you're trying to understand economic mobility.
Anything else, Ken?
No, just a quick comment on this income distribution thing. I read a piece in the State Journal over the weekend, and the professor, I forget his name now, made a very interesting point. He said the new jobs that are going to come due to Trump or anybody else in manufacturing will go to graduates from Purdue in engineering, I believe is what he said, meaning that automation has been the cause of this big change, and we simply have to get people trained to take advantage of that. It's not what was happening overseas, basically, at all. It's been automation, and so somehow we have to help people increase their skills to be able to take advantage of the automation. And that's going to be a challenge because you need less people with more automation, and it's going to be an interesting thing to find jobs that are rewarding for people to do as technology does more and more for us.
Yes.
But thank you very much for listening.
That is a huge challenge, isn't it, Robert?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that our sense is probably technological changes have had very, very much to do with the change in the income distribution that we've seen. You know, that it is people that are relatively more educated, that have had exposure to certain kinds of innovation in their childhoods, or whose parents have sort of introduced them to you know, the right educational spheres that would allow them to take advantage of these technological gains that is probably driving quite a bit of the sort of income distribution inequality that we see. And so I think that that will be something absolutely that we should take a hard look at and focus on, because there are solutions to problems like that.
Let's talk about the distribution of income to the top, I don't know, 1% or whatever percent you want to give us. Why are they making so much money?
Well, I would say that that is not, you know, there are probably a lot of reasons. Some of the things that I would point to are actually the things that we were just talking about. You know, increasing what economists would call returns to education, which sort of basically is a fancy way of saying that people who can take advantage of these technological changes and make money off of them tend to be the people that are more educated, often people in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields. And that very likely has a whole lot to do with changes in the income distribution that we see.
Adrian in Milwaukee asks, are there similar things happening with work futures in European countries, or is this just happening in the U.S.?
So there have actually not been many comparable studies to ours in other countries around the world. Now, I think that, or at least we hope that sort of our study will help pave the way for some of these future studies to look at either this metric or related metrics to try to understand changes in economic mobility across the world. But to this point, there really have not been that many rigorous studies of exactly the phenomenon that we look at. Now, there have been studies of related phenomenon that, you know, for example, the relative mobility metric that I mentioned earlier in other countries around the world, which actually show that many other countries, many developed industrial countries, do better by some of these relative mobility metrics than the United States does, that the decline has been less steep. But I think that this is certainly an area of active research, not just here in the United States, but across the world. And it's something that we very much hope our study will help people in other places, you know, across the globe understand this phenomenon.
We're welcoming phone calls for our guest, a research fellow at the Stanford Institute of Economic Policy Research, co-author of this latest study by the Equality of Opportunity Project, that shows that when we think of the American dream, we think that children will grow up to be more successful than their parents. But this study shows that half the children born in the 80s grew up to earn more than their parents after adjusting for inflation. But it's a drop from 92% of children born in 1940. We have yet to concentrate on the particularly steep drop-off among children born in the middle class and for those particularly in several states, including the industrial Midwest, what has happened in those specific states. We'll talk about that as we carry along here and welcome more of your phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Before we go back to the many phone calls, Professor Pflugi, let's talk about what's happened in certain states. Are you referring to the industrial Midwest states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, where all of this problem has been even larger than other states? And if so, why?
Sure. So we certainly have seen the steepest declines in the probability of a child beating their parents in many of the states that you just mentioned. Now, I think one of the interesting sort of facets of this question in the industrial Midwest is that these are not places that are currently significantly worse than the rest of the country. The reason that the decline has been larger there is actually that for kids born in 1940, these places were excellent. You know, being born in the industrial Midwest sort of gave you one of the highest chances of beating your parents if you were born in 1940. And many of these states are now average or below average. And so you've seen sort of these precipitous decline in several of these states in the Great Lakes area. And I think that that likely speaks to some of the things that we've been talking about how much of these declines are centered in the middle class, that technological gains have sort of taken away a lot of the manufacturing jobs that might have existed in this area, particularly, as I said, for the middle class. And, now these areas look, in some cases, worse than the average state.
Let's go back to phone calls. Nancy is next in Verona. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I have a question. I'm just wondering if it's a fair comparison to compare between 1940 and 1980, because aren't more parents more successful in 1980 than they were in 1940?
Yes, that is absolutely true, no doubt. By any standard of real income, people's families are wealthier in 1980 than in 1940. Now, I think what's important to keep in mind, though, is that just because, families in real dollar terms are better off now than they used to be, doesn't mean that the economy is not still growing. The numbers that you hear thrown around, the 1.5 to 2.5% real GDP growth every year, means that everybody should be getting better off as time goes forward. And it's the fact that a lot of those gains are being concentrated among fewer and fewer people that really explains much more of this whole question of whether or not somebody beats their parents than it is sort of the overall level of growth.
Did you look at all in the study at ways for middle-class people to get better breaks from the government, tax credits of some kind, childcare, higher breaks for childcare, various forms of relief from the government? Is that a factor in this, do you think, Robert?
I would say that this is really not something that we explored much at all. But I also think that it's sort of, part of your question, I think, speaks to a broader issue of how exactly do you want to define the American dream. Now, sort of the number that we throw out, the 92% to 50%, defines, income in a particular way as sort of the sum of a husband or a wife and their spouse's income. From all sources, but I think that it's not totally clear, to me at least, that the American dream necessarily means more tax breaks from the government or sort of greater tax relief or something like that. I think it's equally valid to think about the American dream as actual earnings and earning more than your parents actually earned. And I think even by that metric, you see pretty much exactly the same declines as you see by the metrics that we were citing earlier. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that our study is advocating in any way for certain types of redistributive programs or what have you. I think that you could make an argument that those might help, but you could make an equally valid argument that it's really, government policy concerning the distribution of growth. How can we help people share more equally in the technological and economic advancement that our country's been seeing?
And certainly that's one of the issues, maybe not confronted directly, except by some of the candidates, that guided this election, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, what our group focuses on is not so much sort of these political questions of what is the particular best sort of policy idea or the particular correct way of thinking about, you know, what can be done in a very specific situation, but rather that we want to describe as best we can what has been going on for families in the United States so that you can sort of lay the foundation, set the base for discussions on particular policies to be better informed, to be more understanding and more representative of what is actually going on in the United States, so that people in a position to make policies can then, have sort of the most information that they possibly can about what sort of effects their policies might have. Now, I think, having said that, there are certainly policies that we think probably would do better than others, things like, as I said before, education, improving public transportation, perhaps changing zoning laws, that would help, I think, people share more equitably in the growth that this country's seen.
Thanks so much for your call, Nancy. We go to Danny in Sheboygan. Hi, Danny. Hello, Danny. Call us back, Danny. Jeff in Warren, Illinois. Hi.
Hi there. You were just touching on this, really, but the problem I see with people who I talk to about this is they always wind up phrasing it, well, we can't do anything about the problem because we don't want to cut into the income of the doctor and the lawyer down the street. We don't want to disadvantage anybody and quote, limit their income. But if I'm hearing you right, I don't think it's really the doctor and the lawyer down the street. I think it's a very tiny percent of the population that's kind of siphoning off the bulk of the pie. And the pie is just so big, and it's not going to get bigger by magic. I mean, they get a bigger chunk every year. And meanwhile, all the other classes are overpopulating. They're getting 2.3 children out of every family, and so you can't expect them to have a larger chunk of the pie when there's turning out to be more and more and more of them, even while these super rich people are getting all the advantages.
Robert.
So I think that there's certainly, and that's a really excellent question, that part of that is exactly the argument that we've been making, that it's that the income is going to fewer and fewer people. The aggregate income, I should say, is going to fewer and fewer people that is driving a lot of what we see. Now, I think that to the more specific question of, you know, whether or not sort of these types of changes would be siphoning off income from, say, the doctor or the lawyer down the street, as you said, I think that, you know, most people would say we want to avoid something like that. And what our group really advocates for is trying to increase opportunity for people across the income distribution. So some of the things that we've talked about earlier in the program, education, transportation infrastructure, increasing, as another of our studies has shown, that the exposure to innovation as a child or being in an innovative sort of locality or environment seems to matter a lot in terms of your participation as an entrepreneur later in life, that all of these things that you can think of don't necessarily mean redistribution, you know, taking from the super rich or the relatively rich and giving to the poor. I think what we think about them more as is investments in localities that tend to benefit people that are maybe not sharing in the economic pie in the same way.
I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, because this stayed in my mind in the form of a question. When you talked about those fields where there might be more opportunities, you mentioned science, technology, and math. I'm wondering if it is a goal of yours to make more money than your parents did, or at least to have a good income for your lifetime. Does it make sense to sort of plan your life, if you have the possibility of going to college, around those career areas?
Well, I think that that's my feeling is that that's more of a personal question about the preferences of a given individual. You know, it's certainly true that people that go into science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the STEM fields that people talk about, do make more money as adults than those that don't on average. But it's really, I think, a personal question about whether that's something that is important to you or not. Now, in terms of the things that I think we can answer well are for people that want to go into a field like that, do they have the opportunity to do so? And that actually we have a study that we've been working on that speaks to exactly that question. Now, we show that people who grow up in an area that has a particular type of innovation, for example, a place that makes, say, a particular type of silicon computer chip, for example, tend to have children from that area that will grow up and innovate in exactly that area of technology. Now, what that suggests to us is that sort of exposure as a young adult or young child even to an innovative environment and particular types of technological advancements tends to predict success later in life in those areas. And so if we want people, or to the extent that people want to go into these STEM fields, increasing the exposure that they have in childhood through something like internship programs, increased technology education in school, more company participation in the local community, that could go a long way towards increasing the opportunities for people that do want to go into these fields.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. Julie in Madison, hi.
Hi. Hey, Kathleen, I love your show. You're the bright spot on NPR for me, on WPR for me.
Thanks, Julie.
I'm fascinated by, I'm 50 years old. I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a medical doctor degree. And my parents are between 80 and 85. But because, and they worked, I'm one of 10 kids, they worked like dogs their whole life.
Yeah, bad.
I'm the only one of the 10 kids to have gone to college, and I did enough for all of us, I think. But their retirement benefits from their slave work are providing really, really well for them. None of their children will, myself and my siblings, none of us will have those kind of pensions or retirement benefits. So in that way, they'll do far better than any of us forever.
Well, that's an interesting area we haven't even explored yet. A lot of those have gone away, haven't they, Robert?
Oh, that's absolutely right. No question. Now, the main results in our study are speaking to income, particularly at age 30, but I think that the point that you make, which is a good one, that sort of certain types of benefits, certain types of old age pensions, to use your particular example, have been declining is definitely true, at least among some industries. And that sort of makes the problem that we are attempting to describe potentially even more dire if you see this as a big problem. Measuring income at age 30, it gives us these numbers about your probability of beating your parents, but as time goes on, it's certainly possible that the kinds of pension benefits, for example, that people's parents have will mean that people are doing worse than their parents later in life as well. Now, I can't speak, at least using our data, to any numbers on that particular question, but I think it's a very valid argument and something people should really be thinking about. One thing that I can speak to is we did...
Yes, yes, we have about 15 seconds left.
Ah, okay.
Okay, well. So one thing we'll have to talk about down the road. Robert, thank you very much for being with us and doing this study. It's an important and interesting topic. Thanks.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me.
Robert Pflugi, a research fellow at the Stanford Institute of Economic Policy Research, co-author of the latest study by the Equality of Opportunity Project. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this program. Lisa Nalbandian, our on-air production. K.P. is leaving us. He has 2 days left, so why don't you send some messages and thank him for all he's done? He's terrific. He's moving to Asheville, North Carolina. So go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and say thanks.